This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Lay on the head on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here.
Ho ho ho! That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the lay line there.
Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to our chat with British offshore sailor Brian Thompson, one of the most highly regarded offshore sailors out there, and as you will have heard in part one, a man with a pretty big presence in the book of sailing world records. Even Brian can't remember how many he's broken. If you haven't listened to part one yet, go back and give that a spin first. We spent much of it discussing Brian's early career and his time spent with the all-time adventuring legend, Steve Fawcett. Brian spent a lot of time at sea breaking records with Steve. It's a great listen. In this edition, we're off around the planet again on the Vendée Globe, then the Jules Verne Trophy, and we discuss all there is to discuss about sailing big boats fast in big seas. So get your notebooks out. Before we pick things up with Brian, if you're enjoying season four, then please do head over and show your support at buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. It's very easy to use, and your support allows us to stay ad-free so we can keep on delivering these uninterrupted chats with the biggest names in the sport. If you've done so already, a huge thanks for the coffees. If not, why not head over and take a look? Your support really does make a difference. We kick things off in part two with Brian about to set sail on the 2008 Vendée Globe. You may well have heard both Sam Davies and Dee Kafari on the podcast, and Alex Thompson, of course, all of them 2008 Vendée competitors. So we get back into things as Brian is about to take over Mike Sanderson's Pindar Amoca 60.
As people come to say goodbye to you on the dock, there's plenty of tears in their eyes, and that sort of brings it home a little bit. From halfway round the world, it was basically a boat building exercise to get to the finish. The keel was still attached to the boat, but not attached to the rams. So it was completely free swinging inside the boat.
We're kicking off part two with the Vendée Globe, Brian. Solo sailing. I mean, how big a part of your career at that time was sailing alone? And how did you end up on the Vendée start line?
Well, I always loved the romance of sailing on your own and the challenge of it. So I'd done the Austar, which was solo. I'd done the Mini Transat, which was solo. But that was about it. I hadn't done, as I mentioned before in the previous episode, the Solitaire de Figaro, where they're solo sailing all year round. So I'd just done, so I'd probably, you know, 3% of my sailing had been solo, but the Vendée was definitely part of my sort of seven summits or 100 summits of sailing that I wanted to do, because I wanted to do every big race, and I was lucky enough to have done, you know, the round the world, the Jules, well, the round the world record, and some of the Volvo, and many other races. But the Vendée was always it felt quite unachievable. And really it was, it's just a series of fortunate circumstances that Mike Sanderson, who I'd sailed with on the Volvo race, was going to skip a Pindar, which was a 60-foot boat designed by Wan K, same as the designer of his Volvo 70 winning Volvo boat. And he wasn't able to skipper it because he'd got a job with the British America's Cup team running the whole show. And I'd known Andrew Pindar from many other races like the Transat Jacques Vabre, where he'd supported many great sailors, particularly female sailors like Emma Sanderson. And at that time, there was no plan to do the Vendée Globe. because Mike wasn't interested in the Vendée Globe that long, a solo race. He was more interested in winning the transatlantic races. So the boat had to be more designed for transatlantic races than Southern Ocean ones. But I went into it with an interest in doing the Vendée Globe, and Andrew fortunately loved that idea. And he said, well, we'll support it. We'll look for another sponsor and try to make it happen. So I think that was the year before the Vendée Globe. But unfortunately, even before I'd started the job, the mast had fallen down on a round the island race on Mike's last race on the boat, which was actually no fault of Mike or the boat designer, but it was the mast was really not up to scratch. It was quite benign conditions. So for the build up to the Vendée, we really did no training at all because we were fixing the mast. Then the mast broke again on the delivery to the Transat Jacques Vabre, which was actually a year before the race. And we then had to go to another supplier to build a mast, which didn't come until the summer. So nowadays you really have to qualify way, way in advance of the race and do various races. But then there was a 30 boat limit and it reached 30 boats, but it wasn't over. There wasn't a waiting list. So I could enter quite last minute, which is very fortunate. But the boat had not done a single race, had not finished a race before the Vendée Globe. And I'd just done a double transatlantic trip. So over to Bermuda and back. That was the qualifier for the Vendée Globe in lieu of having done a race. So I went to start line with very few miles on the boat. And I think I was the only boat to finish. I had not previously done a race because there's probably five or six boats in the same sort of situation. So during the race, plenty of things came to light that might have come to light earlier had there been more time to prepare.
I mean, you had done a lot of ocean miles by then, but as you say, slightly unprepared, you know, time was against you. Also, I mean, the boat had been designed, as you say, to cross the Atlantic. It was perhaps, you know, more powerful than you would have wished for. Can you remember that feeling on the Vendée start line? I mean, how did it feel to be there? How big a deal was it?
Well, I've been to the 2000 finish to see Ellen MacArthur finish with Kingfisher and take the boat back to the UK, which is incredible. And I've been to the 2004 start and finish. And I knew what an amazing event it was and very emotional to be there. And 2008 was, well, obviously we were rushing to get ready and everything. So it was almost more emotional being a spectator than a competitor because you've kind of got lots to do to get out there. But it was amazing as people come to say goodbye to you on the dock, there's plenty of tears in their eyes. And that sort of brings it home a little bit that you're going and you know, you see who your real friends are in that sort of situation too. But going out through the canal is an unbelievable experience. It's like going out into the Wembley Stadium or something, and there's literally tens of thousands of people holding up banners and flags and waving at you as you wave to them. And that's so bizarre because 2 hours later, you're absolutely on your own on the boat. So it's such a juxtaposition between tens of thousands of people and all the attention, and then you're just there on the boat going. It's a strange feeling because you're going away from where you're going to. So you spend the first part of the trip leaving La Sable d'Olonne till you get to the latitude of sort of New Zealand, and then you start coming back. So you're getting further away from home. So it's a strange feeling, but you can't really think of the whole globe in one chunk. You just think of, I want to get to Cap Finisterre, or I want to get to Canaries latitude, or I want to get to the equator. And then from there you think Cape Town. So you've got to break it down to not get overawed by what you have to do. But I knew I wanted to finish the Vendée. There's one thing to start it, but to be a Vendée Globe finisher, that was a real challenge. So every day or every moment, I was thinking, I have to get to the finish. So therefore, you don't do things you haven't done in training. You don't do anything you don't know. You're just always trying to keep the boat going to the finish. And plenty of things broke as we went along. So from the halfway around the world, it was basically a boat building exercise to get to the finish.
I mean, you did well, didn't you? First Vendée, you finished fifth, but the running repairs were endless. There's a very famous one about the bow nearly falling off. Tell us about that day, Brian, and how you dealt with it.
Yeah, well, sailing in the Southern Ocean, normal sort of conditions, 35 knots of breeze, downwind. Probably had two reefs and a fractional zero and a staysail up. So you're going along at 17, 18 knots at that time. And then I noticed there was sort of noise from the bow. And there's various very big longitudinal bulkheads which encapsulate 4.5 ballast tanks up forward, which aren't needed downwind, so they're empty. But they had cracks in them and they were moving. And that actually, when I called the designer up, he's like, don't worry about them too much, but I think you should stop and fix them. And unbelievably, luckily, the normally grey, cloudy skies cleared and it became sunny and the wind dropped. For two days, I basically just trickled along with just a jib up, I think. And it was as calm as on the Solent in the south of Australia in the Southern Ocean. And I managed to cut up various floorboards and screw and glue them to the broken panels and then laminate all over the top, which took a couple of days. And the help of people all over the world who I was calling for advice, boat builder friends in different time zones, who were incredibly helpful like Rob Folloy in Devon, who was a very good boat builder who built Formula Tag for Mike Birch, who I mentioned in the previous episode. And he really helped me because I'm not a super skilled boat builder, but I knew I only had limited materials and I couldn't get it wrong and I had to make sure they went on in the right way. And in the end, I remember holding two jet boil burners, one in each hand, going full blast, trying to warm up the area to let the epoxy go off, warm up the bow area, and trying not to fall, almost falling asleep into the jet boils. Burning.
What could possibly go wrong?
Then the epoxy had gone off, and literally an hour later, it was back to 40 knots. And I couldn't have fixed it because the boat would have been moving, so I couldn't have sort of closed up the crack. It would have without a calm weather. So I was just so unbelievably lucky.
I remember talking to Gabar and also Mishdez, and they said, you know, preparing for the Vendée, you got to prepare for something going wrong every day. And then if you accept that something is going to go wrong every day, then it's much easier to deal with.
Oh, that's true. Yes, psychologically.
Yes.
And if you get through a day where nothing breaks, it's like a holiday. Yeah. But literally, from halfway around the world, I basically was only on deck just to change sails. And I was fixed. The alternator had massive problems. And I had two alternators, brand new, when the first one broke, I put the second one in, that broke as well. And it turned out that they had both had a factory recall on it. So I just got a bad batch of alternators. So from then on, I was just reliant on the solar panels for the rest of the way. So I had very little power. I remember Stan Honey helped me a lot in trying to repair these alternators. So I had them in bits, and he's a genius at mechanical and electrical gear. The oil in the keel rams started eating the seals in the keel rams. Eventually the keel rams were just loose, and so the whole bilge was just filling with oil, and I'd have to be pumping up by hand, because I had no electricity, pumping up by hand the keel and then refilling the rams with this used oil that was mixed with seawater in the bottom of the boat. And it was just quite epic. And some sail repairs, and then the boat building side of things. There was an endless things to do. So it was more of a boatyard trip. But amazingly, even though I'd stopped for 2 days and had all these issues, I think I was only 24 hours or so outside third. But I was very lucky on the leg from Cape Horn to the equator. That was very quick, so managed to catch up quite a few boats on that leg. And Cape Horn was exciting, 85 knots of wind there. That's the most wind I've ever seen. In fact, the race committee, I'd left Cape outside Cape Horn, gone through the Straits of got past the islands out into the South Atlantic, and the race committee actually called me up, which I don't think they've ever done before, and said, oh, turn around, you've got to go back and hide behind an island, because it's going to be so much wind. And then Dee Kafari also had to wait near Cape Horn in the same storm. So that's the danger of Cape Horn, where you're fixed in one place with can be a big storm coming through.
It was a mad addition, wasn't it? I mean, I think the attrition rate was huge. Only 11 boats finished. Yes. from the fleet.
Yeah, 11 out of 30 finished. Yeah, that maybe it's the worst attrition rate, and also the best victory ever with Michel Dredrio. Having to start pretty much 2 days late and winning by, I think, nearly 2 weeks. It's absolutely incredible.
You've got a bit of an incentive when everyone's ahead of you, haven't you? Pick them off one by one.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely, totally incredible. Yeah.
You know, solo nonstop around the world. We talk about it a lot on this podcast, but generally in sailing, I mean, so the achievement sometimes gets diluted a little, but it's a very big deal, isn't it? I mean, what kind of sailor do you need to be to finish a Vendée Globe?
I think you need this right psychological makeup, which is going to really help you to do it. As you mentioned, being good at repairs, because they're definitely going to come up. And, you know, although you can't stop for any assistance, you know, if someone gives you a bolt, you know, you're out of the race. But you can repair yourself, and you can get advice from other people. So the shore team can help you. So you don't need to be an absolute expert in that, but you need the right equipment and the right people to help you to do the repairs. You've got to be good at the navigation. Obviously the sail trim balance, the risk balance, risk reward ratio, you've got to get that right. And you've got to accept that you're not going to see anyone for 70, 80, 90 days and be happy with that. And for that to work, you've really got to love sailing, I think, and be totally happy being in your own company and being in just the company of waves, the old seabird, and be totally absorbed in the race. Because then you'll then you're busy the whole time.
When you cross the line, as I said, in fifth, just behind Sam Davies with Di Cafari behind you, how did that feel? When you reflect on it now, knowing that you'd achieved it, that you'd finished.
Oh, that was such a good good feeling. I was like, was it a thorn between two roses, Sam and Dee in there? And because I think in that 24 or a little bit more than 24-hour period, there were four boats finishing, which is a huge amount of the number of finishers, all finished quite close together, which was fantastic for the spectators. So there were a lot of people to see our group in. And so the finish was absolutely astonishing with the number of people there. And it was an absolutely beautiful morning. And the night before, I didn't even know I was going to really finish because the keel had actually broken. The keel was still attached to the boat, but not attached to the rams. So it was completely free swinging inside the boat. So if the boat heeled over, the keel just carried on aiming straight down. So it gave you pretty much no stability at all. And so I was just, that was probably, I don't know, 80-100 miles from the finish. So I was just trying to get to the finish. And I thought, well, fifth place is going to be better than sixth. So I was really trying to stay ahead of D. Who would have been talking to most of the way around, ahead of D to the finish. So it was just a real relief to finish because the boat was really falling apart at that point without the keel being attached. Luckily, it wasn't too windy. It was upwind, but maybe 10, 12 knots of wind. And it was just such a great feeling to be back and then see the family and the shore team again. It was and your other competitors that you'd just been racing against. Yeah.
Where do you think the Vendée sits in the world of sailing? You know, is it the toughest test there is?
I think it must be. I mean, it's incredibly hard even to get to the start line now. I mean, look at the number of boats trying to get in there. I mean, to get the sponsorship, get the right boat, get the right team, qualify now, let alone do the race and finish a race, it is incredibly hard. I mean, the last Vendée was so much drama in that, and I'm sure this one will be the same. So I think it is, well, it's so long, it's so hard. But then sometimes you look at this old Archaea old team challenge that's happening right now, and those boats are much faster, so the trip is shorter. But maybe that's an even higher challenge to race an old team around the world nonstop by yourself. It's another level of skill and commitment to be going 40 knots all the time.
Well, we'll see if they get round.
I hope so.
In that edition you did, I think there was four Brits in the top 10. You know, why do you think there hasn't been a British skipper who's won it? You know, why do you think that is?
I think it will come from a British skipper that has embedded himself or herself in the French ecosystem. So it will be Sam Goodchild, Sam Davies, Jack Brutal. I think you just absorb little things here and there that are going to help you. And if you do it outside France, it's got a lot harder. And the French do cooperate a lot together, and the teams mix and learn from each other. Different, you know, shore teams will be learning from one or the other. And the boats will actually train together as well. So you'll find your weak spots and maybe encourage you to train more, to do more miles. So I think a British winner will have a house in France. I think it will happen. I mean, when I did it, there were, I think, seven British entries, which was incredible of a fleet of 70. But all those entries had really been funded, except probably for Steve White, which was very last minute sponsorship had been funded before the financial crash of 2007. So this was a year later that the race started. So I think they were still working on contracts that had been signed in better times. But then since then, I think with this financial crisis, and then there was changes in the law for hospitality. So you couldn't offer to take hundreds of people out sailing and offset the cost of it from, and that worked very, very well. Loads of people went sailing, and now it's much harder to do with these rules. So hard, but perhaps harder for a British sponsor. Well, the French sponsors can get direct or just lots and lots of media attention. And so it works through that better. Boat just accelerated to 48 knots. And so it went from 48 knots to 28 knots in half a second. It's always been my dream to do a solo multi-hull trip around the world. I do think that's the ultimate challenge.
One of the early retirees in that Vendée, Brian, was the offshore legend and wonderfully talented sailor and all around just a nice guy, the crazy talented Loïc Perron. I mean, he ended up putting a Jules Verne challenge together on the giant Banque Populaire 2. And it wasn't long, Brian, before you were on the team. How did that happen? And just perhaps put in context how extraordinary that was. I mean, his boat was entirely crewed with French offshore multi-hull legends and you.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, there was a Spanish legend as the navigator, which was Juan Vila, and a Swiss, Yvan Ravesin, who was a real multi-hull expert on offshore and sailed many Jacques Vabre race, two-handed on almost. So it was a bit unusual to have a non-French speaker, actually, because Juan went to a French school, and obviously Yvan spoke French in Switzerland, was in the Swiss French part of Switzerland. It was a bit of a chance encounter, how it happened, that I was doing I was invited along to a course in Spinlock here in Cowes, and one of the team of Banque Populaire was there, who was Kevin Escoffier, and he said, maybe you should, because he knew me from the Vendée, had heard of me through the Vendée Globe and perhaps some of the other multi-hull stuff, and so he was quite anglicized. And he said, "Well, you should give them a call, or I'll put you in touch." So that's really how it happened. If I hadn't gone to Spinlock that day to learn about clutches with some shore team from various French offshore teams, that might not have happened, because they might not have thought, "Oh, cool, let's call Brian," because they'd be looking in their pool. But I went sailing with them and it all clicked really well.
Tell us a bit about the boat. I mean, I sailed on it when it became Spindrift, you know, later, and it's an amazing machine. Tell us what it's like sailing a multi-hull that's that big.
Oh, that massive. It is so, so, so massive. Even if you see it now, it's breathtaking, even compared to an old team, which is 105 foot. This is 135 foot and so wide with such massive hulls, huge mast, massive, massive winches. So there's, you can have 8 grinders, but moving everything is just glacially slow because the loads are so huge. But then once you get her going, she's unbelievable. She'll do 37 knots all day through anything downwind. And because it's so big, it really takes a big wave to make it a rough ride. So it's, and you're very high up, so it tends to be spray on the deck, but not big waves. And just absolutely blazing speed without the foils. So... And then inside, it's it's pretty big for a multi-hull. So there's room for bunks, day bunks, a galley. Then on deck a sort of seating area, so you're ready to help. So it's really well set out for a round the world trip. So you'd be on watch for 4 hours, in your bunk for 4 hours, and then on standby for 4 hours. That was the routine. And unusually, I've normally always been sort of semi-navigating on boats and watch captaining, but this time I was just helmsman had a great navigator, great skipper, three great watch captains. So I was just really focused on doing a good job driving and helping to change the sails and things. So it was just a bit like being back on ABN AMRO 1, just in a totally well-oiled machine, from the management to the boat preparation. Everything worked and everything was at the cutting edge. It was a real pleasure to sail with them. And I think that's finishing that race is the only time I've ever not wanted to finish a race or a record, because I knew I'd never sail with such a on such an amazing boat with such an amazing skipper and crew again.
Pete Cummings, who sails with you on Argo, on the Mod 70 Argo, he told me that you'd been told off once by Loic for sending it too hard. Is that true?
No, I was there. It was actually someone else driving, who shall remain nameless. But we were in the Southern Ocean. We weren't too, like, 500-600 miles from Cape Horn, and it was snowing at the time. So these snowstorms come in with a lot of wind. So it might be 25 knots and it goes up to 35 or so, but very, very dense, heavy wind, as you can imagine, as it's snowing as well. And I think we didn't notice this gust coming, and the boat was caught up a little bit too high, flew the hull, helmsman bore away, boat just accelerated to 48 knots, and then plunge, as it tends to do when you're only on one hull bearing away, it will plunge into the wave ahead. And so it went from 48 knots to 28 knots in half a second, which everyone down below just flew forward. Loic came up not very happy with us. it was quite right of him, because, you know, our goal was to not to do 48 knots, but to get to the finish. In fact, 40 knots was really our speed limit. So when we would probably hardly ever went above 40 knots, although the boat was capable of doing far more.
Hey, what was it like down south, you know, in the big sea, that boat?
Well, it's probably the best boat you could be on to be down south. A, because it's fast, so you're not down there that long. It's dry down below. You had some protection when you were on deck. You had a place you could dry your boots and your foul weather gear. Doesn't make any warmer on deck, but at least you're not putting on wet boots. And then you felt quite safe with that team, with that skipper and that team that you were a navigator, that you would go, you'd be fine. But we saw a lot of icebergs on that trip. We had 1 week where we were just surrounded by icebergs all the time, and we had to slow down. The nights are not very long, but we still had to slow down to keep a lookout for the icebergs. Yeah, we went by one, which was absolutely enormous. It was miles long and looked like 200 meters high or something. So it was a bit of an ice shelf that had come off. And then off that, there were loads and loads of smaller icebergs. And the real small ones, the bergy bits, as they call them, that's what would get you, because they're just in the middle of nowhere. They're the end of a bigger piece. So you can't really see that. One passed very close to us, but the size of a car, the solid, I probably weighed a few tons. And we just missed that. And another one I remember was mostly they show up on the radar. Also, we're using light intensifying sort of monocles to look. But one was, because they're all different shapes, one was absolutely like someone's bald head out the water, just completely spherical, floating. And you could see all the other icebergs on the radar, but this one, absolutely invisible on the radar.
Wow,
luckily
terrifying.
It was daylight, so we could just enjoy it. But say the Vendée Globe, you won't see an iceberg now. Or I think the old team challenge, they've got ice skates. So it's only really the Jules Verne where there's no limits. So we were using a Canadian company that had satellites that were moving ahead of us to look for, they were maneuvering satellites to look down at the ice and spot the bigger bits for us.
Wow, but it's not fail safe.
No, it's not totally fail safe, because those little tiny ones, the end of a giant iceberg, they can't pick that up. They just pick the bigger ones more than 200 meters.
Oh, let's talk about the Jules Verne trophy. I mean, it is steeped in romance, of course. The initial goal to break the 80 days set out in Jules Verne's famous novel. It is one of our sport's ultimate prizes, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I remember every winner, you know, back to the Bruno Peyron initially, and then obviously Peter Blake and Robin Knox Johnson, the second winners, and then I saw Bruno Peyron win it again with Nick Maloney at the Salon Nautique in Paris, or were presented with it. And it lives in a maritime museum opposite, on the other side of the Seine to the Eiffel Tower. So literally, you look out the window where the trophy is and there's the Eiffel Tower. So it's an amazing place, and it's an amazing trophy that just is suspended by magnetism. It just hovers there. And it's about 12 feet long. So we had our whole crew of 14, and they all could be lifting this trophy and putting it back into its sort of position where it just stays there with magnetism. So it's a very, very beautiful trophy. And we were all given a little sort of model of it. So we all have a mini one of it at home. It doesn't work on magnetism. It's just held up by a little pin, but it's a great memory. And it was great to get the whole team together again to get presented with it. And no, I'm very proud of that particular record.
What was that like, all of you with your hands on the trophy? It was a pretty special moment.
Yes, you will have to put some white gloves on, because they'll put the trophy on the in its sort of hover position, and it's just going to stay there. They'll put a case over it, and it'll stay there forever. So you don't want any smudge marks on it. But yeah, we're all in a line holding it. Loic in the middle, obviously, as a skipper, and it's really quite incredible. The circumference of it is sort of like the diameter of the sun, and then if you look at it in the other direction, a little lengthwise, then it's the same as the Earth. So it's very cleverly designed by its American sculptor, I suppose, who created it.
How amazing. And how amazing to do it with Loic, you know, Mr. Multihull in France, isn't he? I mean, what was he like to sail with when you look back? And, you know, how tough is it? Just give our listeners an indication of what it's like to be battling to get a record like that, constantly sailing against the clock.
Yeah, I think he's got a lot of pressure as the skipper from the expectations of the sponsor, of the team that's behind all the campaign. But his job is to be serene above it all. And he except for the time I just mentioned when we went too fast. He was always very, very serene and calm, even though I sort of knew also as had been quite a lot of skippering, it probably wasn't feeling very comfortable going through all the icebergs for a week when the things could have gone badly wrong. He's responsible for, you know, everyone's life, let alone the record. So he's really having to decide, should we, that was a big decision. Do we spend a week sailing through this iceberg zone, or do we take a longer route, avoid it and go into light air and perhaps not get the record? So his choice was, let's go through the area, but we're going to slow down and do it as carefully as possible. And that was clearly the right thing to do. And he'd come on deck. He has very famously smoked cigarettes quite a lot, but not just normally, but in a holder. So he very elegantly comes up and talked to us. He only drive very occasionally, but because we have a routine of who's driving at what time within the watches. So it's tricky to come up on deck and just say, oh, I'm driving now. But sometimes when there's something was critical, he'd drive and he'd really very, very able on the helm. And Mike Sanderson is the same way as well. He wouldn't drive very much, but he was clearly one of the best drivers on the boat and just come to drive just when needed, or to feel the boat and to see if everything's okay. Loic's main job was probably, or time was spent with the navigator, Juan Vila, who was looking at the weather whole time with the help of Marcel Van Triest, who was our shore team. So looking at the strategy was the main job. And also our project manager of the whole team was on board as well, which was quite useful. Again, in these sort of risk-reward decisions, like if you break something, you know, are we going to pull out? Are we going to carry on? That's sort of it's great to have Rona there as well to help make those decisions. So it's a very great pleasure to sail with Loic. And very fortunately, I'm going to be sailing with him next week in St. Martin on a gunboat 66.
That's a lineup. I mean, Brian, what do you think the limit is with the Jules Verne? It seems to be getting harder to break, isn't it? I mean, your record in 2011 was 45 days, 13 hours, 45 minutes. The current record, Francis Jolland's record, of course, set 6 years later, is 40 days, 23 hours and 30 minutes. And Spindrift, well, they've been trying to break that since Jolland set that record in 2017. I mean, what's it going to take to break that record?
Well, I think IDEC, which Francis Jolland sailed and broke the record, is probably very slightly slower than Banque Populaire, but he had absolutely incredible weather, unbelievable weather, for almost all of that trip. And then, as you mentioned, Spindrift has tried to break it several times, and I think Gitana has tried a couple of times and not made it. So I think if the record is broken into... you could say six parts, really. The first bit down to the equator, the second bit down to the Southern Ocean, then you've got the Indian Ocean, then you've got the Pacific Ocean of the Southern Ocean, to make up the Southern Ocean. Then to come back up, you've got the South Atlantic again, and then the North Atlantic. And I think on Banque Populaire, we probably had three good ones, one average one and two bad ones. And that made our 45 days. While Francis sailed brilliantly with a very light team and absolutely pushed the hell out of the boat. But he probably had five good oceans and one average one. So I think we would have done the same time on Banque Populaire. And even though the old teams could potentially a bit more fragile, but potentially even faster, especially in the Atlantic. because of the foiling in the flat water, but perhaps not faster than Bank Populaire in the south. I think they'd still struggle to beat it without that amazing weather, which was the weather that they had for the Vendée Globe, that also set a record time, and also the Francois Gabart set a solo round the world race in that same time period. So something about that year was incredible for particularly getting through the Southern Ocean with long lows just transiting the whole of the Southern Ocean that you could just ride doing 850 miles a day, which eats up the miles. While, say, on our South Pacific, we were going dodging the icebergs for a week, going really quite slowly. And I think at Cape Horn, we were only just ahead of the record. And then we had a decent South Atlantic and decent North Atlantic to break it up. So I think 40 days can be beaten, but it's really going to take a lot of attempts to get the weather right. I think of it like a slot machine, you know, where you pull the handle and you get cherries, and to get all, you need all of them lining up, or at least five out of the six lining up.
You need a bit of luck and a lot of patience.
Yeah, a lot of change to put in the machine.
You mentioned the old teams. I mean, six books are currently racing solo around the world, and, well, there's been a few issues, of course, already, but they're all still in the race. I mean, what are your thoughts on racing boats that big and that fast around the world alone?
Well, I think it's a huge challenge. It's a bit like the first Vendée Globe. People thought it couldn't be done, and they did it. And there was a race in 2000 that people might remember called The Race, which actually Bruno Peyron created. And we were there with PlayStation at the time. And I remember, I think it had six multi-hulls starting, three of these giant Ollier Cats, and PlayStation, and then two other smaller boats. And I thought at the time, you know, is anyone going to make it around the world? But in fact, it was only us that didn't make it around the world, because we hit something off Brazil and stopped, but the rest made it around. And so I think it's, and Francois Gabart has made it around the world solo, and Francois Joyon has. So I think they can do it. It's hitting objects in the water. So really, as Tom LaPerche has found out, is going to be the big problem for them.
You don't fancy it, Brian?
It's always been my dream to do a solo multi-hull trip around the world. In fact, even before anyone did around the world multi-hull record, I've always wanted to do that, but never really managed to pull together the funds to make that happen. But I do think that's the ultimate challenge, the most difficult thing you can do, which is racing around the planet on the most tricky boat, and to do it as fast as anyone. But that record of Francois Gabart is very, very impressive at 42 days. So very, very hard to beat.
What about the foiling in Mocha? I mean, you're Vendée, of course, on a very powered up Mocha 60, but you sailed it essentially outside. I mean, what about the new style of foiling in Mocha, sailing from inside the cockpit? What are your thoughts on all of that?
Yeah. Yeah, well, my boat was really unusual. I had a taller mast than a Volvo 70, more sail than a Volvo 70, more writing moment than a Volvo 70, and it was only a 60. I think I was the only one ever to sail that boat single-handed. But now I think they're the masts are all one design, so probably 3 meters shorter and easier sail plan. But the... with the foils, their speeds are incredible. I was watching them pass us on the Jacques Vabre, and they were doing 23, 24 knots average on each sked, which is, incredible. And the sheer water over the deck would mean you really couldn't stay on deck. I remember on the Volvo, you're basically just about able to hang on when the water comes over. So it's very sensible that they have the protection so they can push harder. Is it as much fun for them? I'm not sure. I think that some sort of semi-opening one would make sense. Some sort of a sliding roof, so that when it's nice weather, well, why not be outside more? And I think the winning boat in the Jacques Vabre, they actually did drive a lot at night. Drive a lot in the daytime and just used a pilot at night, rather like we were on the Class 40. So maybe there's more to gain there of actually being outside in the better conditions and then inside in the Southern Ocean when it makes sense.
Yeah, interesting. Quite a few of the current younger generation of offshore talent have told me how generous you are with your knowledge, how patient you are with passing on your skills. You know, how important is that, do you think? And who is that guru for the younger Brian Thompson?
Well, I mentioned when I first bought the trimaran in Maine, that was Walter Green and Mike Birch, who were real pioneers of multi-hull sailing. So I was very lucky to have their advice, their subtle advice. I learned a lot from reading. Rob James, who was a very famous early British sailor who sadly passed away sailing on the trimaran off Sorkham. He wrote a great book called Multi-Hulls Offshore, and that was my Bible. So I'd say I learned a lot from him. And just really, I try to be a sponge from everyone that I sail with. And I've been lucky enough to sail with, you know, great people like, you know, Stan Honey and Mike Sanderson, Juan Vila, and that's been a great, and Loic Peyron, Thomas Cavill. Wow, when you think of it, being very, very lucky.
But you've also imparted a lot of your own knowledge. I mean, you look now at the new generation of offshore sailors, you know, Sam Goodchild, and all those kind of guys have passed by Brian Thompson and learned a lot. I mean, how important is that for you to be generous with what you know? Oh.
No, I think it's really important. I'd really like to do more, and I'm especially proud of Sam Goodchild for what he's done, because he sailed a lot with me with the Mod 70s. I sort of got him onto the team, and he's always had the burning ambition to do the Vendée Globe, and it's so satisfying to see that how well he's doing, winning the Imoca series this year, and getting to do the Vendée Globe in a competitive boat with a position to possibly win it. But I, you know, mainly hope he finishes it and is happy with his result. And luckily, I'm going to sail with him again on Argo for the Caribbean 600 in about a month's time. So it's good. Now he'll be telling me, he'll be imparting lots of knowledge to me this time. So it goes both ways.
I think you're a very generous teacher, Brian. I mean, if you look back over your career, I mean, you've achieved so much. And as we said at the start, so many records. What are you most proud of, do you think, in your career?
There's, I think, lots of highlights. Probably if I have to pick one, it's where I was just a cog in the machine, which was the Banque Populaire record around the world, the Jules Verne record. As I said before, there was no time I've ever not wanted to stop, so to speak. And just at the time, I thought, well, that's the highlight of my sailing, and it probably still will be. But there's so many other highlights, you know, finishing the Mini Transats, all the Ostar solo is and the Vendée solo, those you can't really say those aren't amazing life experiences. But really, so many great, I mean, with Argo finishing the Caribbean 600 just ahead of Maserati, overtaking them right at the end, and just the excitement of that is amazing. The joy everyone was feeling at winning that race. And that can, I hope that just keeps on continuing.
Well, the adventure continues. I've already said, Brian, haven't I, that I spoke to quite a few people when I was researching this podcast, and one of them, well, I won't say who, but at the end of our chat, quite wistfully said, Brian Thompson, the world's best multi-hull sailor. And then he paused and finished it with, and the world's loveliest guy.
Oh.
I mean, that's quite a summary from your peer, isn't it? I mean, how do you feel knowing that's what the sailing world thinks of you?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm the world's best multi-hull sailor. I'd say I'm one of the most experienced. I've been around the longest and perhaps outside France. But there's so many amazing multi-hull sailors there. But I'll be very happy to be in the top 20 there. That would feel very good. No, I've had so many great experiences from my career in sailing, and I've been really fortunate to meet so many lovely, lovely people that are friends all over the world. So, you know, there's still lots more to do, but I'm very excited about the future, but very thankful for everything that's come up so far.
Brian Thompson, wonderfully modest. In my eyes, anyway, the world's best multi-hull sailor. Well, many thanks. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you very much.
The very talented Brian Thompson. Brian, many, many thanks for your time. It was great to have you on the podcast. And to the many friends of Brian that chipped in with some stories, thank you. I know several of you will have been waiting for the ice cream van story, and we did ask Brian to tell it, which he did, but I'm afraid we sort of ran out of time here. If you've heard it already, you'll know how funny it is. If you haven't, next time you see Brian, buy him a pint, sit him down and ask him to tell you about the summer he spent selling ice creams. I do have to say also a quick thanks to photographer Mark Lloyd and to fellow photographer Richard Langdon for sending us some photos of Brian. Many, many thanks for sending them. It's much appreciated. And that's it for this month. Until next time, if you're enjoying what you hear, do buy us a coffee or two. It's super easy. Head over to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast and do your bit to help us bring these uninterrupted, ad-free chats from the biggest names in our sport. Before we go, a big, big thanks to Tim at Vertigo Films, whose relentless work makes these podcasts happen. Tim, a massive thanks, as ever. Keep in touch via social media. I'm Shirley Sale on Instagram and Twitter, and Shirley Robertson on Facebook. And let us know where you're listening. That's all from us this month. Thank you so much for listening. Have fun on the water, and sail safe, everyone.
Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Slingshot head-on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here.
Ho ho ho! That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the line
on there.
Gaining on the line
on
there.
We're looking at 10-5, 42. Matching him on the boundary, yeah. Copy.
This is Castle One standing by. Out.